Previously on Beta.
Shall we play a game?
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
I computed the aliens. They are capable of sinister and dangerous acts.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you think that virtual reality is just a crazy idea that will never really happen? Well, think again.
There's a lot of skepticism about it because this is a business and a technology that's crashed and burned so many times in recent decades. But the technology is here now, and it's really convincing.
David Ewalt joins us to give us an inside look at the virtual reality revolution. And Aaron Gibson has a mission.
Day to day, doesn't matter what the situation, do not let anyone dilute your power. Women are constantly told to be less than, to be quiet, to be under. Don't let anyone do that.
Aaron joins us later. But first, kick back and think about your dream vacation. Do you imagine yourself swimming in a nuclear lake or exploring the infamous suicide forest in Japan? Chances are that sounds more like a nightmare vacation. But some people actually do enjoy such macabre experiences. David Ferrier is a New Zealand journalist and the host of the Netflix documentary series Dark Tourist. So I asked him, what exactly is dark tourism?
Dark tourism is this idea, I suppose, of people that travel to sites of death and destruction as opposed to going to a nice beach or a resort.
Yeah, and the roots of dark tourism go all the way back. We can trace them back to like the gladiator games in ancient Rome and people attending public executions, people being, you know, watching people being beheaded. But it was two academics, John L. Lennon and Malcolm Foley, who came up with the name dark tourism in 1996, actually put that name on it. How big an industry is dark tourism? Do you have any idea?
There's no exact figures on it, and there's been no studies that have shown how big it is, but I guess when we were researching the show, we just took to social media and started, you know, looking at hashtags like dark tourism, and there's obviously a large volume of people that traveling to these places where something a little dark has happened, and I think it's exactly for the same reasons as you mentioned with the gladiators. You know, we're always drawn to the macabre on some level.
And it fits within, as you say at the beginning of each episode, you're interested in the weird and stuff off the beaten track, right?
Yeah, that's, you know, when I was working, sort of doing an entertainment sort of journalism round on the TV news here in New Zealand, I'd always be drawn to kind of people doing strange things, you know, the fringes of society, cults, you know, just people. I know people, I sort of consider myself to be a fairly boring person. And I think just to entertain myself, I just like being around people doing unusual things. So I guess when we started working on Dark Tourist, I sort of was thinking about this, you know, do I want to dedicate a year and a half of my life to this? And looking at the sorts of places I'd go and the people I'd meet, I just sort of thought it was the dream way to spend that time.
Mm-hmm. In the first episode of Dark Tourist, you traveled to Medellin, Colombia, to investigate narco-tourism. What is narco-tourism?
It's been popularized, I suppose, with, you know, movies like Blow and then shows like Narcos, where essentially you're, as a tourist, visiting the sites associated with the narcos in Colombia, primarily Pablo Escobar and his crew. So there's, you know, there's a lot of debate on the ground about how much weight is given to this sort of tourism. I mean, you can go and visit the old prison that Pablo Escobar built for himself to be incarcerated in, and there's huge signs up there saying, you know, no tourism, and yet all around that prison there are tour groups arriving by the busload to tour that particular prison. And I guess where it gets pretty ethically murky, and I mean, that's why we wanted to explore this area as well, because it is incredibly ethically murky. You know, we were being shown around by Popeye, who was Pablo Escobar's hitman. And, you know, he served his jail time, but he did kill over 200 people, including his girlfriend. And now he's this, essentially, he's rebranded himself as a YouTube celebrity, and he's incredibly likable. And because of shows like Narcos, people kind of treat him like they just bumped into Beyonce or Jay-Z or something. Mm-hmm. He's like this larger-than-life figure, and people are just amazed that he's there. They're getting selfies with him. And you kind of have to stop at times and just go, like, no, this guy is, he's not a good guy.
A couple of narco tourists from New York had come up to check out Pablo's prison. They hadn't expected to run into Popeye, and they're starstruck.
He's famous all over the world, so.
And then what do you think of, you know, the whole story?
What they did was awful, but some people love him, some people hate him.
Where do you stand?
That's a good question. I just want to know the history. That's about it.
It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, like a dream come true with me. Like, this is Popeye.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they loved him.
What did you learn from talking to him? You mentioned, and this comes up in the episode too, in the voiceover you talk about. Well, no, you say it to his face. You're so likable, yet you've killed, you know, you're a murderer. You've killed more than 300 people. So was it frightening for you to talk to him? Can you take me back to tell me about your frame of mind while you were talking to him?
Yeah, it was a strange thing because I personally would sort of flip between the two because he was so charismatic. He was like hanging out with that friendly guy at the bar or at the pub. He was just so nice and so charismatic. But then there are times, there was another tour going on at the same time, and something the tour guide sort of made a snide remark as he walked past Popeye, and mm-hmm. he changed. Like, you saw a little sort of flash in his eyes, and he got, you know, all the humor was gone, and he left and walked over to this guy and got up in his face, and I don't know what he said exactly, but the other guy certainly backed down and wasn't being at all cocky anymore. And, you know, at moments like that, you do remember what he did and the fact that he doesn't seem particularly sorry about it. I mean, I wouldn't want to spend time alone with him because I feel he's someone who can just flip very easily.
How much did you struggle with the ethical questions involved in just like having a guy like this, a guy, a convicted murderer, putting him on screen and giving him screen time?
I suppose, like with a lot of the topics we covered, we were just there to observe and to show what happened. I mean, these things are happening. People are turning up in droves. And I think just in showing the way people operate, it's giving the audience sort of a chance to think about how they feel about those situations. I mean, I've always sort of been of the opinion that you can't ignore something that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'd prefer to show the world what is happening in a certain place. And, you know, the number of people that have come up to me or tweeted me or Facebooked me saying they had no idea this particular industry existed, and they're starting to have discussions about this and think about this for themselves. I think that's why we made this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I noticed that throughout Dark Tourist, you're kind of caught between two roles. You're an investigator as a journalist, but you're also experiencing the various Dark Tourist activities along with these other people. So I'm curious about how this dual role as observer and participant affected the way you approached your work in the series.
Oh, I still think I'm figuring that role out for myself, mm-hmm. to be honest, because, no, I mean, that's an interesting thing. When we were sort of looking at the show, the original sort of plan was for me to just be a complete observer from the sidelines, following the tourists and just gauging their experience, because I suppose my background, although it was in light entertainment journalism, it was always sort of to be that observer and just to report back. It's the way a journalist works, right?
Yeah.
But then it's just the nature of making a series that is going to be interesting as someone who's hosting the show. But essentially, we just sort of found out as we went, it's just much better if I get involved and have those visceral experiences myself. And then it was just a matter of, okay, how am I going to experience this?
Yeah, well, for what it's worth, I think you did a really good job of finding a good balance between the two. In the second episode of Dark Tourist, you visited Milwaukee here in our great state of Wisconsin. Why?
We went there because Jeffrey Dahmer lived and killed there. And yeah. We knew there were serial killer tours, especially in the United States. There are so many serial killer tours. And so we were thinking, okay, we're obviously going to cover this sort of phenomenon in Dark Tourist. Which one do we do? And Milwaukee just seemed like a combination of a really beautiful town and a beautiful setting. The tour was really well established and a lot of people went on it. And I am intrigued, like a lot of people are, by serial killers. And Dharma was just someone that I sort of probably knew the most about. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up going there.
I'm very much into spirits and into death. That's something I've
You're into death.
I'm into death.
It's Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yes,
who
Jeffrey
caused
Dahmer.
A lot of death.
He did cause a lot of death, but he was like the perfect storm of issues that I think caused this man to become what he was. So I actually have a fair amount of empathy and sympathy for him.
Right, so that's something I'm struggling with, because I understand the empathy to a point, but then at the same time, he did absolutely unforgivable things. So, you know, the empathy can only go so far.
He didn't enjoy the act of killing at all. He just wanted someone there for him.
You also arranged to meet up with Wendy Patricas, the lawyer who defended Dahmer in court. Can you tell me about that meeting?
She was amazing. She was working with the lead lawyer on that case, and she was sort of the junior defense attorney, and she had just almost gotten out of law school, and it was her job to sit with Dahmer and to get all his, just get his narrative from him. So with Wendy, he went through all his killings and his whole background and his whole psyche, and she sort of took notes through all that. And she had, you know, she had drawings that he had drawn her of the layout of his apartment and, you know, what his plan was to get this big sort of almost shrine organized in his on his dining room table. And he had drawn all this out in detail for her. It was like some sort of drawing out of True Detective or something. She was just a great part of that, because after, especially in that particular episode, we had spent time on this tour and things got pretty tacky and pretty silly. And then to suddenly meet someone who had defended him and could talk to his actual qualities and his personality and what he had done, that added this level of gravitas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As I'm sure you know, friends of Dahmer's victims weren't happy about this tour, which is called the Cream City Cannibal Tour. How does that affect your thoughts and feelings about the tour?
We didn't want it to treat it as an infomercial for this place. I don't think we even mentioned the name of the tour. We just sort of wanted to show it for what it was and to treat it respectfully, because obviously, you know, this happened in the not too distant past, and there have been protests about it when it first started, which have all calmed down now. But I think someone who watches that certainly wouldn't get any kind of approving tone. I think for me personally, I found the whole thing reasonably distasteful. Mm-hmm. And I think anyone watching the particular tour would probably find a similar thing.
What was the darkest dark tourism experience you had while filming the show? Can you point to one?
I found spending time in Kazakhstan at the Polygon quite a sobering experience, because we were there for quite a long time just because of the amount of travel it takes to get there. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the most, you know, one of the most atomic bomb places on Earth. It's where the Russians tested a lot of their nuclear weapons. And, you know, the landscape is just very, for want of a better word, it's just incredibly depressing. There's just nothing there. There's these huge monolithic structures rising up out of the ground that we used to take technical readings of the blasts when they went off. And they're all just, these huge concrete structures are still there in the landscape. Mm-hmm. And we were there with a doctor for some time who, he's in the documentary, but his wife passed away from cancer relating to radiation. He gave us the name of a doctor who worked at an orphanage we ended up going to, and a lot of the kids there certainly had the after effects of radiation. Mm-hmm. Seeing the effects of those tests still playing out today, that was pretty dark. It didn't get much dark. I mean, when you've got kids who are deformed from nuclear testing, you know, it probably doesn't get much darker than that in the show. But again, like we that was important. Like that particular part of the documentary sort of started off as a bit of a road trip. You know, me and Andy, who was this dark tourist, venturing into this landscape. We'd all heard about the Polygon. We went swimming in this nuclear lake that had been made from an atomic bomb blast, and then to suddenly be in the orphanage and sort of go, you know, this isn't entertainment. This isn't just an adventure. This is how it affects the population here. Being able to get that information out and sort of suddenly present that to viewers, I think, was, you know, again, part of the reason we made the show.
Yeah. Why do you think people are interested in this, in dark tourism?
I think it's a combination of things. I have the personal belief that everyone is terrified of dying, even if they think they're not. I think they are on some level. And I think dark tourism and visiting these places is a way to talk about death without having, you know, it gives people the language to talk about it. And, you know, it's as simple as, you know, human curiosity. It's, you know, it's why do you sort of look at a car crash when you drive by? You know, everyone has that sort of curiosity if they want to see something, probably see something morbid. That's why people look, right? It's simple curiosity. And yeah. I think that plays into it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. Do you think there's something going on in our culture right now that is allowing dark tourism to become increasingly popular?
Oh, I think it's a combination of things. I think people, a certain amount of the population are freer to travel probably, and thanks to the internet, people know about some of these places and can get there. It seems like the world is in a pretty dire, especially when you look at the United States, things are in a pretty dire situation. I think people do start thinking about how bad things can get, and they maybe want to learn about how bad things have gotten in the past and be reminded of that.
Yeah. Well, when times, especially as you mentioned here in the U.S., become even more dystopian and more apocalyptic, more or George Orwellian, do you think that dark tourism will become more or less popular? Isn't there a chance it become less popular because we're kind of living in a dark tourism world?
Yeah, it's funny. I thought about that. I mean, I'm always kind of fascinated with the media people are consuming, because at the moment it feels like we're never getting as darker entertainment, and people are watching it and they're devouring it. It's not like everyone. I think a certain part of society wants escapism in their viewing and their media, and then there's another half that just wants to dive deeper into the misery.
David Ferrier is the host of the Netflix documentary series Dark Tourist. You can find out more about David at wpr.org/beta. Do you think virtual reality is a recent invention? It's not. It goes back about 17,000 years to the famous cave paintings in France.
When you stand in the center of one of these caverns, there are animals all around you. And as you turn and look around the cavern, they seem to run around you. It's like you're in the middle of a hunt.
David Ewald says virtual reality is about to get real. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. When you think of virtual reality, you may think of the 1982 Disney movie Tron, starring Jeff Bridges. David Ewald is an award-winning journalist and the author of Defying Reality, the inside story of the virtual reality revolution. He thinks we may be closer to virtual bike races than we thought.
Hey! Hold it right there!
Yes.
You mean yes?
Yes.
Is that all you can say?
No.
Know anything else?
Yes.
Positive and negative, huh? You're a bit.
Yes.
Well, where's your program? Isn't he gonna miss you?
No.
I'm your program.
Yes.
Another mouth to feed.
Yes, 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 yes.
David, do you think that virtual reality is for real? Pun pretty much unavoidable.
I do. I think there's a lot of skepticism about it because this is a business and a technology that's crashed and burned so many times in recent decades. But the technology is here now, and it's really convincing. You know, unfortunately, it's kind of one of those you have to see it to believe it things. But people who've tried the real cutting edge hardware and who do it like myself, like it's really hard to deny that it's compelling and that it's real and that it's happening.
Mm. So was there something, because yeah, as you've mentioned, you've tried a lot of virtual reality. So is there one VR experience that you can point to that really convinced you that this is legit and for real?
Well, the moment that was the real thing that pushed me over, that convinced me, was a demo of one of the prototypes of the Oculus Rift, which came out in a consumer version a couple years ago. But before it actually was released, I did a demo of that in a hotel conference room at one of these tech conventions a couple years back, and was very skeptical going in about the technology. I'd tried earlier ones, and they all well, frankly, they made me sick. That's the way that these systems usually break, is they make you nauseous.
That's not good.
No, it's not. And I'm particularly sensitive to that. So going into this experience, I did not have high hopes. But I put on that headset and really found myself transported to a different place. And that's when I realized that, you know, even if the technology isn't perfect yet, it's very convincing to certain parts of your brain. It's just good enough at this point to really make you lose yourself in it.
Wow. So, yeah, so that's proof of concept. If you really got sucked into that world and really thought you were in that world, that's like all you need to believe in it, I guess.
Yeah, I've kind of come to the conclusion that virtual reality works because it's speaking to a lizard part of our brains. Like, we can understand on a very conscious level, oh, I've got this plastic thing on my head. These graphics aren't perfect. I know they're computer generated. Like, you can understand on that level, this is all fake. But the lizard parts of your brain just know, oh, I looked around. I saw this terrain. I saw these people. That's what's happening. The lizard parts of your brain are not hard to fool. And the technology is now good enough that you can fool that part of your brain. And then you really just forget. It becomes where you are.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned the big clunky piece of plastic that you have to wear. I imagine that's one of the things that needs to be improved, and that brings us to the question, what are some of the glitches that need to be fixed before we'll see virtual reality headsets and equipment showing up in a lot of homes the way we see TVs and the internet now in the majority of homes?
Well, comfort is one of the main issues. The headsets right now are big and kind of heavy. Most of the high-end ones have wires running off them connecting you to a computer. You're also staring at a screen. It's a very high-resolution screen, but it's a screen an inch or two from your eyes. And so in addition to being uncomfortable on your head, it's very tiring for your eyes. And so a lot of people find that they have a hard time using virtual reality for more than half an hour or an hour, and that's a huge barrier to future adoption. But that is one of those things that the headsets will get better and better. They'll get lighter and more comfortable, and people are also researching other technologies, that things that like are holographic light fields where you're not staring at a screen, where there are actually photons being shot into your eyes, so it's not tiring on your eyes at all. It just looks like the real world.
And computers are going to be, it's going to be expensive for processing speed to increase. That means fancier, more expensive computers, right?
It does, but there's also some innovations that are making the computer's job a lot easier. One of the innovations that I expect in next generations of this technology is eye tracking, which is a fairly simple thing if you think about it, that, you know, when you look at a character in VR, it would be nice for them to look back at you.
Sure.
That makes it more real. Actually tracking where your pupils are pointing and what you're looking at makes the experience more real. But what they can also do is, if they're tracking where your eyes are looking, the system can do something called foveated rendering, which is really just a super high-tech way of saying, we're only going to draw pictures where your eyes are looking. So right now, the computer has to render this high-definition picture across an entire screen. But if there's eye tracking in the headset, it can do a really low resolution picture on the edges of your vision and only do high res exactly where your eyeballs are pointing. And those kind of tricks are going to reduce the amount of computing power necessary to put you into virtual reality.
I guess there would be no point in having a staring contest with the avatar, right? You wouldn't stand a chance.
It would ultimately defeat you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So how far back does the history of virtual reality go?
I like to think that virtual reality goes back really tens of thousands of years. I mean,
wow.
If you could make the argument going back to cave paintings.
Wow.
You go to some place like Lascaux, the cave complex in southern France, where, you know, lots of people have seen the pictures. Oh, you know, these cavemen drew pictures of bulls and all sorts of, like, wildlife on the inside of these caves. You don't realize until you're there, or if you visit it in a virtual reality simulation, but the caves are meant to wrap around you so that when you stand in the center of one of these caverns, there are animals all around you. And as you turn and look around the cavern, they seem to run around you. It's like you're in the middle of a hunt and you're surrounded by all these creatures. And that is probably what the intention was of these people in decorating these caves this way. They weren't just random drawings.
Wow.
They were trying to simulate an environment and draw people into this other world and say, like, oh, this is what it looks like to be on the hunt. So over the course of the following millennia, the technology obviously got more and more refined. But I think there's a good argument to make that everything from theater to stereoscopy and 3D images and 3D movies. Like, that's all part of the long, millennia-long march of people trying to create better and better simulations to put themselves into another world.
Yeah, yeah. In the early 1980s, a guy named Thomas A. Furness III comes on the scene, and you describe him as the grandfather of virtual reality.
Well, for a long time, virtual reality, or for a long time, 3D entertainment was that. It was the purview of people trying to make entertainment. But as 3D movies got better, and as this sort of stereoscopic technology got better in the 50s and 60s, the U.S. military started paying more attention to it. Tom Furness was an engineer and an inventor who started working for the Air Force and started developing immersive technologies to improve battlefield experiences, which is a fancy way of saying fighter pilots would get into their planes and were just overrun with dials and gauges, and there was just way too much information. They couldn't handle it all.
Mm-hmm.
So Furness said, well, let's set out to find a way to create a better display, a better cockpit, a better interface for people to get information. And his first idea was, well, what if we have like some sort of headset? Like, you could put something on people and we could just give them the bare minimum. We could show the pilots their airspeed. We could show them, here's your target on the ground, here's another plane. By sort of closing off a pilot into this world, into a virtual world, you could control and just give them the information they needed at the moment. And so it was this idea of, well, let's create a virtual cockpit that became the foundation for, well, that needs virtual reality, that needs display technology, that needs interfaces, that needs ways for the pilot to actually physically interact with whatever's happening in his headset. And so he created a lot of these early technologies that became the modern VR industry.
Hmm, interesting. So Jaron Lanier is the guy who actually coined the phrase virtual reality, but what role did he play besides giving it its name? What role did he play in the development of VR?
So Jaron Lanier was an engineer, an inventor, a really smart kid, basically, who sort of grew up on the fringes of society, kind of a nerdy kid, but also very artistic, who became really into this idea of, wow, I can create simulated things. I can make things with computers. I can create things that weren't there. And he got into this world because he was a musician. He wanted to create a way to play instruments virtually. So he started thinking about, wow, like, I wonder if we could make gloves that would allow us to strum a guitar or play a piano or something like that. And he also had a programming language based on music, and he needed a way to sort of move the musical notes around on a staff and put them in different places. And a mouse or a keyboard wasn't really up to that job, so he wanted a way to for your hands to sort of interact with the software world. And because he was producing all this, he started sort of accidentally creating virtual reality hardware. Like, that wasn't his goal at the beginning, was not to create a VR headset and gloves. His goal was, well, I need an interface for my software and for my musical tools.
Yeah.
But it soon became obvious that, wait a minute, this is the real business here. People are interested in buying this and exploiting this technology. And so he founded a company, VPL, to start creating this technology. I say VPL because even Jaron isn't exactly sure what VPL stood for at the time. Mm-hmm. Maybe virtual programming languages. But yeah, he basically just had to invent the name of the company because suddenly he needed to have a company. But he, by creating this company that created these first input gloves and these headsets that were a step beyond what we'd seen before, this was now recognizable virtual reality. Mm-hmm. And this is what you started seeing in the 1990s. Virtual reality became a cultural artifact. It became something that we would see in movies. There was a ton of movies that came out, especially in the late 90s, that were about cyberspace and virtual reality and people surfing into the internet and controlling computers. And all that technology came from stuff basically that VPL had invented. In fact, yeah, if you watch a lot of those movies, they're wearing VPL hardware just because it looked like that was our conception of what virtual reality is. It's the stuff that Jerry Lanier was making.
Yeah, Tron is one of those that probably the earliest VR movie. What other ones are you thinking of? Do you have favorites?
Famously, one of the big ones is not a great movie, but there is a movie called Lawnmower Man, which is based on a Stephen King short story.
But it really has nothing in common with the story, does it?
The Stephen King short story is about a guy who hires a landscaper and realizes that the landscaper is actually a satyr and is like literally clipping his lawn by eating his grass.
Yeah, it's a really creepy story.
So it has nothing to do with virtual reality.
Yeah.
But in the Lawnmower Man movie, the plot is that there is sort of a mad scientist who experiments on his intellectually disabled gardener with virtual reality technology and exponentially increases his IQ, makes him smarter and faster and stronger, but also inevitably psychopathic. And the Lawnmower Man enters the internet and starts killing people and taking over computers.
This is some of the most advanced computer equipment in the world, John. In these gyrospheres, we wear full cyber suits, which completely allow us to enter into virtual reality and move. Your entire nervous system and endocrine system will be in sync with the brain expansion.
Endocrine?
Endocrine. It carries secretions of certain glands like thyroid, adrenal, and pituitary, which regulate growth. Sometimes I think I've discovered a new planet. But what I'm inventing instead of discovering, I've just sighted the shore of one of its continents.
It's silly, but it was, at the time, a really iconic portrayal of, you put on this suit and this headset and you go into cyberspace and you can actually move around and attack computers. And so that was a really one of the landmark films.
Sure. Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I love the story. I should see it, but I guess it's...
If you like bad movies, it's worth watching.
All
right. It's pretty crazy.
Okay, I should check it out. What do you think we're going to gain and what do you think we're going to lose when virtual reality becomes a mass market product, something that we see in almost all of our homes?
I think there's a lot to gain from virtual reality in the sense that this is a technology which will connect people in very profound ways and can give them experiences that are especially profound. Virtual reality at its best convinces you that it's real. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I've watched lots of movies and I can watch a movie and love it and think that's a brilliant work of art, but I've never walked away from a movie and thought like, wow, I was really on Mars there with Matt Damon, or wow, I was really fighting with the Avengers. I enjoyed the movie and it was a piece of art or a piece of just simple entertainment, but it never really convinced me. When I've done virtual reality experiences, some of the really good ones have actually convinced me that I'm there. And then when I leave and I'm thinking about it later, my memory is not, I remember experiencing that piece of media. My memory is, I remember when I was in that ancient temple.
Mm.
I remember when I met that person in a Japanese tea garden and we talked for an hour. That didn't really happen, but the experience is real to me, and that's sort of the way that my brain processes it. These are real experiences.
Yeah, you're immersed in their world. But do you think that there is a danger that we could potentially spend so much time in virtual reality that we ignore real reality, that we're too busy, you know, we spend all this time making virtual connections at the expense of maintaining our real life connections?
I think there's absolutely a danger of getting lost in virtual reality, but I think there's a danger of people getting lost in television and in books and video games. I know, you know, there are plenty of people who just stay home and watch Netflix all day at the expense of their personal relationships.
Yeah.
VR makes that a little bit more dangerous because VR is so engrossing, and because VR can, in a lot of ways, it can really replace real relationships or real experiences. You know, do I need to go visit Egypt if I can put on my headset and it looks just like I'm standing outside of the Great Pyramid? Maybe I really don't ever need to take that travel now. So I think in a lot of ways it is a more dangerous technology in that sense of sort of removing people from the real world. But I think like any technology, it's about striking a balance. The benefits of virtual reality, I think, are going to be stronger than the problems with it. You know, some people will get lost, but the amount of people who find new things and who expand their lives is going to be greater.
David Ewald is the author of Defying Reality, the inside story of the virtual reality revolution. You can find out more about David at WPR.org/beta.
Breast cancer awareness is the invention of AstraZeneca, one of the largest manufacturers of breast cancer drugs. That's like if Walter White had started a meth addiction awareness campaign to help people find out if they love meth.
Comedian Erin Gibson on her mission to dismantle the patriarchy, one pay gap joke at a time. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Erin Gibson is a self-described Southern loudmouth. She's the co-host of the award-winning political absurdist comedy podcast, Throwing Shade. Erin has published a book of comedic essays. It's called Feminasty, The Complicated Woman's Guide to Surviving the Patriarchy Without Drinking Herself to Death. So what exactly inspired Erin to write this book?
Well, I wanted to write a feminist propaganda tool that was accessible to like an 18-year-old version of me. Because I was kind of I was a young lady who was really only interested in smoking Marlboro Lights and dry humping. And I wasn't really aware of the myriad of ways that the patriarchy was making my life and my choices and my existence impossible and hard.
Yeah, yeah. The title comes from your nickname on your podcast, Throwing Shade, which you co-host with Brian Safi. What does it mean to be feminasty?
Okay, I like to think of it as being an unapologetic crusader for your rights, even if people think you're a raging monster.
Would you mind reading the dedication to your book? Because I want to ask you a question or two about that.
Okay, absolutely. To women, you are not my competition.
Yeah, so that raises the question, of course. How big a problem do you think competition is among women?
Well, I think it's massive. And one of the problems with it is it's not like it's explicitly taught to us to see another woman and then just make sure that she's annihilated by all means necessary. It's like a subconscious thing that we're taught that there's limited men, money, jobs, positions, and that if... Then there's another woman right next to us who's vying for the same limited amount of whatever you want to put in there. So now the thing is like sometimes the competition is created by external forces. So like if you're looking at management positions or jobs in the C-suite, corporate suite, there are limited amount of jobs. So I think if we banded together instead of clawing our way over one another for this one special lady job that have been bestowed upon us by the benevolent men gracious enough to give us the opportunity, we could actually topple the problematic system in the first place rather than just fighting for the scraps that were being thrown.
Yeah, and that's a lofty goal. As you say in your book, you say that you want to make sure that women see through the patriarchy's lies and deceit and power-hungry motivations and find ways to subvert and destroy their system. So how do you do that?
I mean, look, it's not going to be easy, and I don't think it's going to be an easy process, but to recognize the female-focused industries who are run by men.
Yes.
Like, I have a whole chapter about the cosmetics industry, and I want to bankrupt those guys by diverting my eyelash and my eyes, my mascara and my eyeshadow dollars to women who are running those businesses.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. You have this whole essay about the cosmetics industrial complex, big makeup. And as you point out in that essay, a lot of women think, and as you just mentioned, a lot of women think they're buying makeup from companies that are led by women. But these companies are actually run by men. So that raises the question, how do women find out which companies are being run by women so they can give them their money?
It took me so long to research and find companies that were run by women because it's not necessarily a thing that is a bragging right, shockingly enough, in the cosmetics industry. So I would say if you know it's owned by a big one of the, you know, Estee Lauder, L'Oreal, Revlon, et cetera, Louis Vuitton, it's probably not owned by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, if it started out owned by a woman and is bought by Unilever or one of the big ones, you know, look at their their board. Look at the people at the top.
Yeah.
Those are the people making all the money. Great that they're employing women, but I prefer that the people at the top of the cosmetic industry understand the difference between concealer and contour. You know what else? I really truly think there are so many, and I could go on for 50,000 days about this, but there are so many garbage ingredients in cosmetics. And I just don't think that if women were at the helm of these massive corporations, that they would be putting terrible stuff in the cosmetics, because they're using them, their daughters are using them, their mothers are using them. There would be more of a sense of responsibility with the stuff that's going in them.
Yeah, very well said. Yeah, I think you're right. I just want to get back to this idea of this competition among women theme that we were talking about a moment ago. How do you think competition among women is different than competition among men?
Well, I mean, definitely there's competition between all genders, but I think men, to me, men compete with the idea that even if they screw everything up, there's going to be another opportunity for them.
Yeah.
And women just don't have that in the back of their minds. I call it the hope differential.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, if you don't get the CFO position, maybe if all the executives die in a plane crash, you'll get another opportunity in 10 or 15 years. Like, the amount of things that you have to overcome to even get a second chance is just insurmountable.
Oh, yeah. I think so, yeah. So how did you transform into what you describe as the, quote, childless, career-obsessed, nail-biting, hell-bent feminist, she-devil banshee, end quote, that you are today? How did that happen? Because I don't think you were always that way, were you?
No, and I want to shout out to Missouri GOP candidate Courtland Sykes for writing a viral anti-woman screed and giving me that jewel of a label. He used it to, talk about what he didn't want his daughters to grow into. And I have happily repurposed the phrase as a badge of honor. So it took me a while. I was lucky to have a friend, Tria Wood, who gave me a copy of Susan Faludi's Backlash when I was maybe a junior in college. And I devoured this book in 3 days.
Wow.
It's a massive book.
Yeah.
And it was amazing because I finally had the language, thanks to this book, to identify what I was experiencing and not just feel weird.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thing with women, we're not really taught to see what's going on around us, so we just kind of feel bad all the time.
Yeah, you mentioned the language that Faludi uses in Backlash. Can you remember? Can you give me an example?
I remember there was one example of a woman who was working in construction. She was the only woman, and she would get in her locker at work, they would put pornography in there. They would put naked women and the like in there to intimidate her and sexually harass her. And this woman was a single mom.
Hmm.
And I just thought, how could you make someone's life that's already being made really hard by America? How could you make it even harder on a day-to-day basis? Just putting so many obstacles in front of her to make a living. And Susan just did a really good job of explaining women's like a specific woman's experience, and then taking her critical mind and saying, this is why it's wrong. And I'd never seen the, this is why it's wrong.
Yeah.
I'd always just been like, isn't Susan in a bad situation?
Yeah. And that's an ideal time. Junior high is a great time to have come across this book, to have read it, right? Because you're in the midst of forming
your
identity.
Yeah, but it wasn't. No, it was junior in college.
Oh, junior college, right.
I wish it was a junior.
Junior high,
I wish I had, like, found this book. The closest thing I had was reading The Scarlet Letter and totally identifying with Hester Prynne.
Yeah. You have some problems with the breast cancer awareness industrial complex, if I can call it that. Can you tell me what you think they're doing wrong?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so when I found out that breast cancer awareness is the invention of AstraZeneca, which is one of the largest manufacturers of breast cancer drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's like if Walter White had started a meth addiction awareness campaign to help people find out if they love meth. It's really suspect.
Yeah.
So that just makes me not trust the whole complex of making women aware of breast cancer, because we're aware. We know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's being shoved in our face at all times that this is a danger. And by the way, not the number one cancer killer of women. It's lung cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
Which you wouldn't think if you look at the propaganda.
Yeah. Yeah, you have this great line in your book where you say there are antebellum elevators that you trust more than some of the charities associated with breast cancer.
Yes, and I'm from the South. I know a lot of antebellum elevators.
I bet you do. So breast cancer is something that has a lot of personal significance to you. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've come from a very big Irish Catholic family.
Third generation, right?
Third generation, yeah. That's right. Loud and proud, wearing my street rat hair everywhere I can. Well, I mean, I've lost two aunts, my grandmother to breast cancer, and my mother had cancer. My two cousins have all had breast cancer. It's kind of like our family thing to have breast cancer. And then personally, because my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer, I got tested for the BRCA2 gene mutation, which I was positive for. So I opted to have a preventative mastectomy and kind of take care of the problem before the problem got me.
Was that a tough decision for you? Was that something you struggled with, whether or not you should do that?
It was. And I'll tell you, doctors didn't make it any easier. I had a gynecologist who asked me if I was, he asked what I was going to do if I wanted to breastfeed. And I said, well, I'm not going to be able to breastfeed if I'm dead.
No,
and I couldn't believe that I had to explain to people that why I want to do this. I was scared. I was really scared. I've lost people in my life who I love.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want the same thing to happen to me. And, or, you know, best case scenario, spend my 30s getting lumpectomies every year. It's just, it's not something I wanted to deal with. So I finally, this was like 8-9 years ago before Angelina Jolie had it done, Christina Applegate. This was when people didn't really understand the motive. And I think now it's a little more acceptable. People get it. They understand why you would have such a major surgery when you don't technically have anything wrong with you.
Mm. Yeah. You're also very, very passionate about having more women pursue careers in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I just feel like these industries are building the future without the input of over half the population. It makes no sense to me. I want all the brains possible on the jobs of building bridges, fixing climate change, perfecting medical equipment, developing a weed brownie that won't make me too high at the airport. I need all these things to happen.
Yeah. Do you have any specific ideas about what it's going to take to make that happen, to get more women pursuing STEM careers?
Yeah, I have like a 3-point plan.
Okay.
So I think first things first, we have to stop discouraging girls from engineering and math and science interests at young ages. We have to, if a little girl is interested in Legos or building blocks or anything that doesn't look quote unquote like girly, we don't take that out of their hands and put a Barbie in there.
Mm.
Number two, systems have got to be in place in U.S. colleges to eradicate gender stereotyping and sexual harassment by professors. There isn't a good one right now, and it's still a situation where it has to happen to 3 or 4 women before anybody gets stopped, educated, threatened that they might lose their career for sexually harassing women out of theirs. And then number three, in the actual industries themselves, we need to take a good hard look at the workforce and make sure that it's not just diverse, but that women and people of color who are working in these industries are supported, heard, and protected from any scientist too stupid to recognize their own bias.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, that's a solid 3-point plan. The subtitle of your book is The Complicated Woman's Guide to Surviving the Patriarchy Without Drinking Herself to Death. So if you could give the complicated women out there who are listening to this interview one piece of advice, what would it be?
Okay, this is the thing that I think is the most important, and it's a little overarching, but I think day to day, doesn't matter what the situation, do not let anyone dilute your power. Women are constantly told to be less than, to be quiet, to be, you know, under, and don't let anyone do that. You have to, and as a matter of fact, when someone tells you not to do something, you should do the improv rule, which is do it twice as much.
Yeah. What about those of us who are part of the patriarchy, the complicated and in some cases, perhaps not complicated enough men? What should we be doing to help women survive the patriarchy? What can we do?
This is such a great question. Okay, number one, listen.
Mm-hmm.
Even when it's hard to hear things that you might be doing wrong, everybody makes mistakes. And we're all victims on some level of the way that we were raised. And I think that feminism can definitely help men with overcoming their own gender obstacles. And number two, stand up for women when we're not around. Mm-hmm. When it's locker room time, when you're hanging out with your bros, BW3s.
Yeah.
And something comes up that you don't think is the right attitude towards women, say something.
Yeah.
We need allies at all turns in every place to stand up for us.
Yeah, yeah.
And unfortunately, right now, it's more powerful when a man stands up for us than when we stand up for ourselves. We're still at that point.
Yeah, which is very sad, considering mm-hmm. this is 2018. Yeah. Do you think, I would imagine you think men should read this book. Are you optimistic that they will?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I hope there are guys out there that are ready for this and they can learn a lot. I've wrapped almost everything in absolute gutter humor, so I guarantee it'll be the funniest way to become an ally.
Erin Gibson is the author of Feminasty, The Complicated Woman's Guide to Surviving the Patriarchy Without Drinking Herself to Death. You can find out more about Erin at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Catch up on past episodes by subscribing to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week at beta@wpr.org or on Twitter @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our technical director and music director is Steve Gotcher.
He had that little element of niceness to him.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
He would just sit there in his chair, and it was his own little shrine to himself.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Well, burp already! Would you burp?